This podcast is brought to you by BMJ Best Practice. BMJ Best Practice offers evidence-based, continually updated, and practical knowledge that will help you make better clinical decisions.
Hello and welcome to this BMJ Best Practice podcast on Frostbite. Kieran Walsh is my name. I'm Clinical Director at BMJ. As the climate changes, we are getting diseases associated with extremes of temperature, like frostbite. Frostbite is classically associated with mountaineering and winter activities, but also occurs in armed conflict and, of course, in homeless people. When it happens, it is serious. It can result in wound infection, gangrene, and amputation. So it's important we get the diagnosis and management of this condition right. To give us more details about the problem and what we can do about it, we have on the line Professor Chris Imre, consultant vascular and renal transplant surgeon, who has also worked on the South Pole Medical Research Expedition. And importantly, Chris is author of our BMJ Best Practice topic on frostbite. So Chris, you're welcome. Let's start off by asking, what exactly is frostbite?
Thank you very much for the introduction, Kieran. Frostbite is a tissue injury, local freezing of tissues, usually in the extremities, usually in fingers, toes, occasionally nose, ears, occasionally also in external genitalia in men. So it's a condition affecting the extremities.
And how do you make the diagnosis?
The first thing to think about is whether or not the climactic conditions are appropriate. So you're looking for a temperature well below freezing, often with a wind chill and exposure over a duration of time. This can be accentuated at altitude. The first thing that people tend to notice is a slight woodiness, a lack of sensation to the extremity. Usually we're looking at fingers here. Toes will often feel numb and maybe stumbling a little bit. And this gradually creeps up on the individual until eventually, after a period of time, they choose to look at, say, their fingers, and they'll notice a woody white appearance and often a loss of sensation, a loss of movement. If it's recognized at that point and appropriate steps can be taken, sometimes there's a degree of reversibility about this.
Okay, thank you. And you mentioned exposure over time. Is it over several hours or several days? Or,
well, there are cases of frostbite occurring as a result of, liquid nitrogen. It's used regularly in clinical practice. Essentially, you're inducing a cold injury. If someone was to have an industrial accident where they spilt liquid gas on them or carbon dioxide or something like that, they could get it in a warm environment. But usually, it's in a more hostile, austere environment, up a mountain, skiing. As you mentioned in the introduction, it does occur in the UK, particularly amongst homeless people if they're out over a number of days. The individual is often hypothermic as well, so it's not just an isolated condition, and there's often an exposure over some hours, but it can occur quite quickly.
Okay, thank you. And you mentioned low temperatures. Typically, how low would the temperature need to be?
Well, that a lot depends on the individual and the sort of equipment they're wearing. So if you are, for instance, in a polar region and you're well kitted out, it might be exposure at minus 15, 20, 25. But you can get frostbite in the UK at minus 3 or 4 degrees centigrade, particularly if there's a significant wind chill factor.
Can you tell us a little bit about how frostbite actually occurs?
So there's often an associated hypothermia. The individual is quite a bit cooler. One of the physiological responses is to shut down the periphery to maintain core temperature. This normal physiological response of shutting down the periphery results in less blood flow and so less heat being transferred to the extremities. And then the next step is you get sludging or slowing of the blood flow through the extremities until eventually it's stationary. And you get the tissue temperature continues to drop. And once it's dropped to about half a centigrade below this is the tissue temperature, half a centigrade below zero, then you start to get freezing within the tissues, within the cells, and then this tissue injury is usually permanent. How long it takes to intervene and remove the extremity from those cold conditions will depend on how severe it is. So if it's recognized at this point, you might have just a little bit of blistering to the skin and you'll make a good recovery from that. But if that was then sustained over some hours or even days, if you're stranded in a remote area, you could then end up having frostbite that would extend up to the ankles or the wrists, and very occasionally for even further than that.
Okay, thank you. What tests, if any, are needed to make the diagnosis?
So usually this is a clinical diagnosis. You're in a remote area and either you or you're looking after someone who's noticed something is wrong, and you're looking for a woody white tissue. A few hours down the line, they'll start to be blistering. So if you come across this individual, maybe after they've been out for the night, you might notice blistering beginning to form. And then eventually, some days down the line, you'll start to see gangrene developing. So it's a clinical diagnosis based upon the situation in which the condition has arisen in and its evolution, and then the appearance.
What would you say are the pitfalls in diagnosis?
The pitfalls are, in terms of the diagnosis, are mistaking it for something else, suggesting that it's not such a serious injury, suggesting that maybe it's just a bit of numbness that will ease off, and it may be that the individual continues on their climb or on their journey and they have a very minor condition that gets worse. The other pitfalls are run with being in these sorts of potentially dangerous conditions. If you've got clumsy, numb fingers, you might have struggle clipping onto ropes and things. You might have a climbing accident as a result of being less able to manipulate things. And then the other thing, which we've mentioned a couple of times, is the hypothermia that goes with it. And that's probably the life-threatening condition. And if one is just treating the frostbite and failing to treat the hypothermia, then again, you can run into more serious problems. So treat the whole patient.
Fantastic. Thank you. One last question about diagnosis and we'll move on to management. As you describe it, it sounds like it could be severe Raynaud's, but it's obviously not. How would you distinguish frostbite from severe Raynaud's, or is that an impossible question to ask?
No, that's a really good question, Kieran, because quite often people do think, people who have Raynaud's believe it's just a worsening of their Raynaud's. And one would expect the Raynaud's to start to resolve after a period of 20, 30 minutes or so. And if the so-called, in inverted commas, Raynaud's is persisting for a long period of time, then you've got a problem. And I saw someone not that long ago who described exactly that. They were riding on a skidoo, a motorized vehicle. They had Raynaud's. They lost the sensation early in the day. They continued to work. They didn't look at their hands. And two or three hours later, it became apparent that the individual had got frostbite. The individual themselves had thought it might have been just an exacerbation of the Raynaud's. Had he stopped, tried to warm up and discovered that it didn't warm up, then he might have avoided a more serious injury. So it's a really good question.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to management. What's the mainstay of management?
So one can divide the management into field management, and then one can talk about hospital management. Field management, the first thing to realize is the problem is related to the cold. You need to take the individual out of that cold condition, ideally get them into shelter. If they've got inadequate clothing, you can change it, get warmer clothing on. Usually it's below freezing, so it's not a question of wet clothing, but occasionally they've got wet and then it's frozen, and so you would want to change that. Warming them up, hot drinks, sugary base to that, maybe some food as well, and then begin to see if they do warm up adequately. And if they do, then it may be possible either to remain in that environment or even to continue with the appropriate additional steps. If the condition looks more severe and it isn't resolving at all and there are significant amounts of tissue involved, you've really got to get that individual out of down and out of the way. If you're at high altitude, particularly above 6,000-7,000 meters, then supplementary oxygen would be a mainstay, along with the, warming them up, but getting them down to a safer place. Once one's got them to a base camp or a safer place there, you can begin to sort of look at them in more detail, making sure, again, we've talked about hypothermia, that you're not missing that. If they've had a fall or you found them, you know, perhaps they've in a gully at the bottom of a small of a climb, they may have injured other things. So you need to just think about other conditions that might cause it, a broken bone, compartment syndrome, something like that. But those are sort of looking again at the whole patient rather than just the isolated thing. Once you've got them warm and stable and in a place of safety, you need to think about evacuation or how you're going to move from there. What you can do in the local situation having is warm the extremity up, usually putting them in a water bath. They're quite difficult to organize in some field situations, but in a large base camp on a big expedition, a couple of large bowls of water warmed up to baby bath temperature. The tissue is insensate. You can't feel it. So it's really important you don't have a cold injury that becomes another thermal injury with a burn as well. So you need to dip your elbow, and checking a baby bath isn't too hot before putting them in. And then warm them up with warmish water. You're usually looking at about 38 degrees centigrade, 38 to 40 degrees centigrade. If you've got some iodine or something like that, you can put into the water. An antiseptic probably makes sense. And then particularly if you've got significant tissue, so this is the whole hand or the whole foot, you need to warm it for a good half hour or so, being aware that the water is going to cool down in that environment. And then simple dry dressings, resting, elevating them, not walking on feet, because this tissue is now insensate. It doesn't feel normal, and the risk is that you get a secondary traumatic injury as a result of walking. And then you need to think about evacuating them back to a hospital-based thing, and we can talk about that when we talk about hospital management.
Thank you. Should you warm up fast or should you warm up slow?
That temperature that I mentioned, somewhere around 38 to 40 degrees centigrade, is the temperature you aim for. If you warm it up at that temperature, it's a fairly quick warming, but you do need to circulate the water. Hotter than that, as I say, the risk is that you'll give them a secondary burn that they're unaware of because they can't feel their fingers or toes. So that's the correct temperature. And then, as I say, probably 20 minutes, half an hour at least, keeping the water at that temperature, which can be challenging.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to hospital management. So when they are admitted to hospital, what would you do then?
The next really important question to ask is how severe you think the injury is going to be. Because if it's at the tip of a finger, a blister, it's not too serious, and one can manage that conservatively with dry dressings, aloe vera cream, ibuprofen. If, however, you think it's a more serious injury, then you need to step up a gear or two, and you're really looking at taking them to a unit where they have access to vascular surgery, maybe plastics, and sophisticated imaging. And the reason for that is based upon the ability to use vasodilators or thrombolytic agents to clear the clots and restore the blood flow. But this can only really take place within the first 24 to 48 hours. So there's a degree of urgency on the more severe injuries to get them into a place of appropriate safety quickly. And this is, as I say, really quite important. It works well in many countries. If I'm thinking of places like the Alps, where you can be flown off Mont Blanc and into Chamonix and in a unit, an excellent unit, within a few hours of the injury occurring. We're quite good in the UK, in places in Scotland, North Wales, and we sort of get less good at how we manage the more severe injuries the further we go from geographically, and also from how commonly they present. But if you can act within the first 24 hours and start thrombolytic agents, then you can make a pretty impressive recovery. And there's very strong data from that. Manny Cauchy was a doctor and a mountain guide in Chamonix, who sadly died in an avalanche, but he published a New England Journal paper just over a decade ago demonstrating that the outcome using iloprost for more severe cases of frostbite was very much better than the conventional treatment. So ideally, you get your patient to a unit that's familiar with these sorts of conditions. An investigation you might choose to do is a technetium scan. This is using a radioisotope and looking for the perfusion of the extremities. If there's no perfusion of the extremities, that by implication means that there's no blood supply there. And if there's no blood supply, you've got a problem. And these are the sorts of individuals that would benefit from iloprost. If you're thinking about using TPA, an alternative thrombolytic agent, this is more aggressive, and you need to make quite sure that you don't have an occult or hidden injury. If they've fallen down this gully and they've got a ruptured spleen, the last thing you want to give them is a thrombolytic agent and cause them to bleed in an attempt to save their toes. So you're looking at moving them to a unit that essentially a trauma centre where they can manage these sorts of conditions, and ideally to units where they have capacity to look after them at a high level.
Fantastic. Thank you. And moving on to pitfalls in management. What are the main pitfalls in management, would you say?
We've been running for a long time a frostbite referral service for the British Mountaineering Council, the BMC, and you can actually look at that if you want on the internet. And that's how we get a lot of referrals. And these referrals tend to be people that present late. You've missed that window of opportunity. You've missed the 24, 48 hour where you could lies, but you've still got quite a severe injury. And so a pitfall is late presentation. And the next following pitfall from that is enthusiastic but not particularly experienced surgeons feeling that they need to operate early. Once you've got the established gangrene, then you sit tight. We're usually talking some months before anything actually needs to be done. And there's plenty of time to seek advice from experts who can advise further. Pitfalls within day-to-day management, it's you need to get the basics right. You need to get the ibuprofen and aloe vera, the good nursing care, and a failure to do that will lead to problems. There's quite a lot of data out there. We've got a number of papers that are available, open access. If people do want advice, in the UK, we offer a 24-hour service, and we'll get back to you as to how we would recommend it. And we're trying to develop this now into a more integrated process across the country so that there aren't just pockets of expertise and pockets of absence of expertise.
Yeah, got it. Fantastic. Thank you. Anything we've missed so far, Chris, I wonder? Have we covered the main points?
I think you've covered the main points. I mean, once we get into the complex areas, then it's a team-based approach. You need good nursing care, good holistic care, looking after the patient themselves, and then multidisciplinary teamwork. So particularly for significant hand injuries, you need to involve plastic surgeons with an interest in hands, how to best manage the particular injury you've got. And they're all unique. One size doesn't fit all. It's about personalizing the approach.
Great, thank you. Years ago, in an exam, a physiology exam, I was asked a question, which was, say, somebody is up a mountain and they had an injury and they're very cold. Would you give them a drop of whiskey to warm them up? And subsequently, I was told not to do that. Can you expand on that, Chris? Tell us about that potential scenario.
Well, I think that's it's a good question. I mean, if you think of the apocryphal St. Bernard's dog that comes and finds you in your snowbank or whatever, they allegedly have a small bottle of brandy around their neck. So there's quite a long history of giving alcohol in this situation. The alcohol will act as a vasodilator, which may well improve the peripheral circulation, but it will actually speed up the rate of heat loss from everywhere, meaning any hypothermic issues, which is likely to be the fatal problem, is worsened. So I think that would be the reason that you were given a slightly hard time when you suggested that maybe it was a good idea, that maybe they were asking you to think about the whole patient rather than the extremity, which is a good message.
Sure, yeah. And Chris, I can't let you go without asking you, what is the South Pole Medical Research Expedition?
So we've actually just had a meeting this morning going through the data. We've set up in Coventry, where I work, a metabolic research registry looking at high altitude and also polar travel. And we've looked at extended polar travel amongst both men and women for some while now, studying about 15, 20 people so far. This particular research trip that we're looking at, comparing the difference of weight loss between men and women over an extended polar journey. We were out there for 47 days. The weight loss varied. The women lost about 3 to 5 kilos, and the men lost between 7 and 13 kilos in weight over that period of time. And we were looking at various other aspects. The interesting thing is that a lot of that was fat. We actually put on muscle, which went against our expectations. And despite this huge weight loss, we were still eating over 5,000 calories a day. So there's quite a lot to learn there. And we're at the early stages of looking at the data. But for me, it was just an exciting trip to go into an extreme environment for 47 days and ski 1,000 kilometers in pretty austere conditions.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Chris. This is really, really interesting subject. And thanks to everybody for listening. We hope this has been helpful, and we hope you'll be able to put what you've learned into action to better diagnose and manage affected patients. If you want to find out more, click the link in the podcast to sign into BMJ Best Practice and have a look at the content on this and other relevant diseases. Thank you once again.